This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason. To live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast.
What's going on, ladies and gents? Welcome to the Warrior Soul Podcast. And today I have one of the most interesting guests I've ever had on this show. Interesting and controversial. His name is Adam Kokesh. And Adam is what you could term a radical libertarian activist. You could also term him as an anarcho-capitalist. To give you an example of what this means, Adam is currently running for president of the United States, or what he would call not president of the United States. He says that his first act in office would be to issue an executive order for the peaceful dissolution of the United States government into 50 independent states. What he is envisioning is a completely voluntarist society that's based on private enterprise rather than government. He says that taxation is theft in all cases, and he's got a lot of really interesting views. Another interesting thing about Adam is that he's got a rap sheet as long as my arm, and you need to visit his Wikipedia page to know what I'm talking about. He's been arrested for a number of his activities, which have all been with the purpose of highlighting violations of individual freedom. So, for example, he's been arrested for dancing in the Jefferson Memorial. Yes, there is a law against dancing in the Jefferson Memorial. There's a really cool YouTube video that demonstrates him being arrested while dancing in the Jefferson Memorial. Definitely check that out as well. He's also been arrested for loading a shotgun with live shells in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. All this is to highlight the fact that somebody can be arrested in our society for doing something that really isn't hurting anybody else. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's violating the Constitution of the United States. Now, I want to say that there is a whole lot that Adam says that I agree with, and there's a whole lot that he says that I disagree with. But in today's society, where politics are so divisive, and we have a media arm in this country that likes to put single-minded views out there with sound bites that don't really get into the issues, I really enjoyed this conversation with him. He is a smart, thoughtful, and compassionate individual who I think has a genuine love for freedom and for people. I also think that you're not going to find conversations like this on the mainstream media. And when you do put people into positions where they have to go into a 60-second or 30-second or 20-second soundbite in order to cut for a commercial break, you're not going to get the whole story. Like I said, really interesting conversation, really interesting guy. I think you guys are at least going to get a lot here that really makes you think. Before we get into the conversation, I just want to say that this podcast is brought to you by F-Bomb Nutrition. Really amazing product made by amazing individuals. They make delicious macadamia nut butters, mix them up with chocolate, with sea salt, with pecan butter. They also make some delicious cheese crisps, and you need to check those out as well. They're awesome. You can get 20% off of your first order of F-Bombs by heading over to www.dropanfbomb.com. Use the code WarriorSoul at checkout, and you will get that discount. With that, let's get into this conversation with Mr. Adam Kokesh, activist, author, U.S. Marine Corps veteran, and now candidate for the non-presidency of the United States. Adam Kokesh, how you doing today, man?
Outstanding. Yourself?
Doing well. Just got through the Christmas holiday, and that's a lot of hecticness right there. Dude, one, thank you for coming on.
Well, Chris, I gotta be a terrible guest and interrupt my host here and say it's seeing a Marine Corps flag on the wall behind you brings so many warm and traumatic memories back. But it's always good to talk to another crayon eater.
I mean, absolutely, man. Absolutely. I think we're gonna hit along. I'm ready over here. I got my 9mm. You got your mace because you're not allowed to have a weapon, right? We're going to get into all that. But for those of you who don't know Adam, before you listen to the rest of this episode, I highly suggest you go to the Wikipedia page for Adam because it's one of the most interesting Wikipedia pages I've ever read in my life. There's a long rap sheet on there. There's a crazy history. He's got arrested for everything from dancing in the Jefferson Memorial, I think, to loading a shotgun with live shells in Freedom Square in Washington, D.C. And now he's run for Congress. Now he's running for not president of the United States. And wanted to bring him on because he's one of the most interesting characters I've ever heard about, ever seen, and ever interacted with. So welcome, Adam.
Well, thank you so much for Chris. Thank you so much for all that. It's a great way. Just go read his Wikipedia. It's an interesting read. We're waiting for someone to make the documentary or based on all the mythologies about me on the internet. But I since you introduced me there as a presidential candidate, I do have to. I have a big caveat, kind of disclaimer with this, if I may. I'm glad you said not president because you know it's not unfair to introduce me as a libertarian candidate for president in 2020. But as I always point out, I'm really running for not president, and the platform is a reflection of ethical values. And what I mean by that is, let me step back. A part of me really dies inside when I'm introduced as a presidential candidate, because you have to be a freaking psychopath of some magnitude to say, I want to be president of the United States of America. I want to be in charge of the biggest military in the world. And I want to have all this power over other people. Like, there's something wrong. We know this. We look at the political process and we get tricked, distracted, deceived into fighting over policy and minutiae and personalities. And you don't ever step back and go, all of these assholes think they're better than the rest of us. What the fuck are we doing buying into this? And you have to question your own sanity then as a victim of this system. So now you're probably going, gee, Adam, how the heck can you call yourself a presidential candidate? Well, it's very simple, because as much as I am truly technically running for president of the United States, we file the paperwork. We have an FEC approved committee, an accountant and a budget and a website and all of that. It is much more accurate to say that I'm running for not president, because the platform here is the peaceful, responsible, orderly dissolution of the United States federal government, leaving us with 50 independent states. Now, sounds like a big deal. And in terms of getting rid of the evils of government, yeah, big deal. When it comes to the practical, what is life in your state like? What is daily life going to be like? Aside from, well, your income's going to go way up. You're not sending your kids to bullshit wars. You're not being spied on by the surveillance state. You don't have to deal with the drug war, the militarization of police. We're only talking about getting rid of the 3 million people who work for the federal government out of the 22 million who work for state and local and federal all together. We're talking about just trimming this destructive, evil layer of fat off the top. And this came about because someone challenged me. They're like, well, Adam, you're a libertarian, you're a voluntarist. What would you do if you were president? And I was like, Well, first I was like, what would I do if I was president? You know, you gotta have that moment, right? But then I was like, well, what would I do if I was president? I quit, go home, get a real job. What do you mean, what would I do if I was president? You give me the ring of power, I'm gonna throw it in the fire.
So let me ask you this.
That's the fundamental difference with this campaign.
Yeah, that's the main difference. You know, in your history, you served in the United States Marine Corps. You deployed to Iraq. When you got out, like a lot of people at the time, you looked at the war and you said, this isn't good. It's not good what we did here. We didn't get in for the right reasons. The loss of life is too much.
Well, I have to confess, you have to remember, both of us were still gullible enough to join the Marine Corps.
And we joined in the same year. I went in 99 and you went in 99.
Yeah. How about that? And I have to confess that I was against the war before the war, but I fell for the rhetoric around the occupation. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. It was a military occupation.
Right.
And I thought that what we were doing was cleaning up our mess and responsible foreign policy. And I volunteered knowing that the war itself was a bad idea, but still thinking, which is really not, I say thinking, this is more believing falsely than thinking, because if I had really thought about it, it would have been obviously false, but that, the Marine Corps was still, a net positive impact on the world, and that we can go and you can heal wounds with guns. So I volunteered. I volunteered to go in 2004. And I wish I could say it was my own intellectual process that led me to these conclusions. But no, I was prodded by some of my own bad decisions, including bringing a pistol back from Iraq the first time I volunteered to go, which in and of itself was only a mistake because I got caught. It wasn't an ethical crime. There's no victim. It wasn't a war trophy or anything like that. I bought it. But I got in trouble with the Marines. And when I volunteered to go back, they wouldn't send me back as I was under investigation. So as a sergeant who spoke Arabic with civil affairs experience, I'm sitting at a barracks at Camp Pendleton mowing lawns and like checking in PFCs, you know. I had to be pissed off to figure it out. Why did I want to go back?
Yeah.
I didn't get a Purple Heart the first time.
You didn't get what?
I didn't get a Purple Heart the first time.
You didn't get a Purple Heart the first time. So you wanted to go back to get the Purple Heart.
To give more. And you know this, Chris, this is like, there's a distinct switch that is flipped for Marines. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can say for Army Special Forces, and yeah, I'm going to brag about the branch BS here, but no, they do flip a switch in the Marines, in your brain, in the training, and part of it's the selection process, but there's a different mentality in Marine Corps boot camp than with any other branch of service that implants in your brain, you haven't given enough for your country until you've died.
I can agree with that. I think that, Marine Corps boot camp in and of itself, it's almost like a tearing down of the individual. It's a tearing down of the ego. It's a tearing down of, I mean, you're speaking in the third person for 3 months, for God's sake, right? And so at the end of it, I was thinking in the third person. And so you get out.
This recruit, sir.
Yep.
This recruit, sir.
No, when I used to think my butthole would clench up a little bit.
Yeah. So my start in activism was with the Iraq Veterans Against the War. When I got out, it was just, this is bullshit. I have to tell my story so that the American people know. But even back then, like I resisted that. You know, and even up until like, man, Chris, like right today, just hearing you say that, I'm fine. Like I used to say, no, they don't break you down. If you're defined by your bad habits, it'll look like they break you down because they get rid of all your bad. And it's like, no. And the way you just pointed it out to me, I haven't considered this in years. But yeah, it's that sensation in your butthole that lets you know they've got to your brain.
So, after your deployment, you get back, and you start your activism. Now, what was going in through your head when you started your activism? Were you already thinking in anarcho-capitalist terms, or
no? So yeah, it's my ideological journey is worth understanding, but still relatively simple. So my parents were anti-authoritarian, and growing up, my dad would tell me, the stories he would brag about were, when he got away with stuff in school or, whatever. And my mom had us listening to oldies, classic rock and singing along. And I got, a big part of that spirit. So I was libertarian in a very superficial sense. I tell this as kind of an apocryphal story, but there was some point in high school where they said, all right, it's civics time. Who wants to be a Republican? Who wants to be a Democrat? And I was like, whoa. I don't have a choice. I have to be totally fucking lame. This is America. There's got to be another option. And they said, well, there's those crazy libertarians over there. They like to be left alone. And I was a punk kid, and I was like, yeah, all right. Yep. Sign me up for that. But that was, socially liberal, fiscally conservative. And that was about as far as my understanding went at the time. By the way, as a libertarian who understands that libertarianism is not a political philosophy, it's an ethical philosophy that you apply to politics. It's I own myself, you own yourself. This is the foundation of ethics. It's wrong for me to hit you because I'm violating your self-ownership, right? It's wrong for me to steal your property because I'm taking something that's yours. It's wrong for me to enslave you. If you don't have a basic foundation for ethics, you really can't build any other part of a worldview consistently. So maybe that's too general a statement, but
I get where you're coming from, because one of my friends, I think you've spoken to one of my friends, Dr. Michael Robillard from Oxford. He talks about this stuff quite a bit as far as ethics go and individualism. But like you said, it's the application of that philosophy to politics. I completely get that.
The reason I am so passionate about communicating libertarianism as the ethical philosophy that it is, rather than the political philosophy that people want you to think it is because I, as a teenage boy, was inclined to libertarianism. Mm-hmm. And if someone had come to me at that point and said, oh, Adam, the reason that you resist authority, the reason that you can see that that's bullshit is because you are starting to get ethics. Now, they won't teach you this in any government school because government is premised on violating ethics. But if someone had come to me then and said, Adam, libertarian, oh, you want to be a libertarian? Let me explain what that really means to you. Let me tell you why there's this consistent, beautiful, ethical philosophy at the core of freedom. I never would have enlisted. I never would have volunteered to go to Iraq. I never would have thought it was okay to kill because a politician said so. Mm-hmm. And so I enlisted in the Marines at 17. When I was still in high school in the delayed entry program, 99. And I wanted to have my life on the line for something I believed in. And I thought that this was the best way to do it. While I was in the Marines, even then I would argue politics, but it was again, from not that ethical perspective, just from that, basic libertarian common sense perspective. The message is so powerful. This message of freedom as ethics, that it really threatens to, I don't want to say, overthrow the current system. It really has the potential for us. It is the evolution of humanity to our next phase beyond statism, beyond violence, beyond centralized control based on coercion. So you could say, yeah, it's a threat. It's the biggest threat there is to the entire current system to say, hey, universal ethics, it's not that hard to figure out. You're unethical here. Let's change the system. And again, just to go back to my practical philosophy here, or practical approach to how we apply this, it's localization. I don't want a revolution. I want an evolution. It's more peaceful. It's more sustainable. It's more compassionate. That's how we achieve this philosophical ideal. It's not by, you know, attack everything that's not perfectly in line with it. Because there are the other thing is that when you get this, when you understand this, it also allows you to prioritize, you know, of all the evils in the world, what causes the most pain and suffering? What's the most destructive? And you know, you can't help but look at government when you ask that question from that perspective of compassion. Yeah. How do we apply this truth of ethics to make the world a better place for other people? So when I got back from Fallujah in 2004, I was disgruntled, but not enough to snap me out of it. You know, it was more the frustration with my experience not living up to George Bush's promises. You know, I volunteered to go to Iraq with a civil affairs team. Mm-hmm. I was reserve artillery. And I volunteered to go active duty specifically because I believed in the humanitarian, compassionate message there that was being sold to the American people as the reason for continuing to send troops into Iraq to occupy, to rebuild the country. And we were subsidiary to the infantry units there, mm-hmm. that were responsible, as you know, for having areas of operation, or AORs, areas of operational responsibility. And civil affairs was a way for them to pacify people when they felt like they needed to. Whereas the impression that I got, and I think the American people got, was that civil affairs, if not in those words, but that the civil affairs types of efforts in Iraq were going to be the priority and the tip of the spear. So I actually volunteered to go back still. Like I said, I didn't get the Purple Heart. I didn't feel like I had sacrificed enough. So I wanted to go back. And that was when I got in trouble for the pistol and ended up at Pendleton. And it was when I got out at that point that I was disgruntled enough to really question stuff. And I have to stay extremely humble in this, that it wasn't like, I read a book about libertarianism and I figured it out and I understood the world and that was it. Here, read my book and everything's better. Cause you know, now that's what I'm all about. But, it really was a process, and especially given the personal investment in the it's easy for a kid, who's gone to a government school and been propagandized for 12 years about statism to snap out of it. You know, you read one book and you go, okay, I got it. But imagine if you put your life on the line for those lies. Hmm. Imagine if you've invested your entire life into those lies. Imagine if you were a cop for 40 years. Imagine if you worked for a government bureaucracy your entire life and retired. Imagine, you know, if you've been on welfare your entire life, and not because you're one of the lazy ones, but because you're a legitimate charity case who's just, you know, you were born with some birth defect and society wants to take care of you. And that's the government is the way that society does that now.
Well, these are all things. I mean, and I want to get into a lot of this stuff with Iraq. I have to say, you know, I wasn't in favor of the war, and I went. I still volunteered, still went over there. Didn't do much while I was there, but you know, the whole thing that I saw when I came back was that we had this very easy roll into Iraq, right? Where all of a sudden it was like mission accomplished, everything's done. But then over the next few years, it quickly devolved, and we ended up, you know, getting ourselves kind of wrapped up in a quagmire there. Now, history being, you know, hindsight being 2020, you know, you look back and you see all those mistakes that were made. You look at maybe Ramadi today as opposed to Ramadi 2006, and it's a much better place, I would say, than it was back then. And the way history works, it's kind of weird because I don't want to sit there and say that maybe Iraq would have been better with Saddam Hussein in charge. But I also disagree with the fact that we went in there in the first place and we spent so many American lives and caused a lot of destruction, right? And so a lot of times I feel like if I sit here and I criticize that movement every step of the way, I'm kind of sitting here and I'm kind of armchair quarterbacking the whole thing. So that, you know, as far as everything goes there, do you feel like Iraq today is in a better place than it would have been had we left it alone with Saddam Hussein, or could it have evolved? Oh, of course
not. No, not even. You can say what you want about Saddam, but you look at the quality of life and just the value of stability. And again, this is why I'm not, you can call me a revolutionary if you want, but I'm not an advocate of revolution so much as evolution. I think that's an important distinction there. And you could point out benefits, but you just look at the overall quality of life. What the population of Iraq it was before the invasion, about 25 million, mm-hmm. and something around 1 million people died. Like, can you imagine? Like, in the United States, that's 1 in 25 people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a conservative estimate. And that's just death, just the one metric of death. You look at Fallujah, fucking A, birth defects from depleted uranium. You want to make any case that a country where birth, like, no, it's, you can't say you have to torture logic to try to say that Iraq is in any way better. And that is kind of personal for me, because I watched those rounds fall in Fallujah. And then years later, had to go and look online at the pictures of the children with birth defects, as a result of what I was a part of. Like, there's no way. It's sick. It's really sick to even try to make that case. But you think 1 in 25 dead? Like, in the United States,
yeah,
we have about 330 million people. I mean, just doing the math real quick, that would be about 13 million people dead, right? Mm-hmm. You think in any, well, the economy's, there's 13 million people died, but the economy's a little better now. Like, no. You don't get to say crap like that with a straight face. It's be taken seriously by someone who has any sense of the perspective of the destruction.
Conflict. Let me get into this aspect of it now, because, you know, you came out and you get into activism. A lot of people in your position would have kind of been lured in by the left. They would have been lured in by socialism. They would have been lured in by a lot of the
perspective. Hold on. You're jumping ahead. I want it, Chris. I'm sorry. I don't just totally mean to interrupt. I have to go back, because, like, I didn't get to finish the part about just the evolution here for what brought me to voluntarism. And I really want people to get that. And I know exactly where you're going, because it connects exactly to that question, because my first full-time activism was Iraq Veterans Against the War. And I was surrounded by lefties. Mm-hmm. And I was there as this arrogant young libertarian. Well, I'm a libertarian. I know I'm right about everything. I just have to prove it. You know, and it was being surrounded by other veterans who were generally leftist, and many of whom had been, you know, because the anti-war left dominated the anti-war movement more than libertarians. Although you see, libertarians were anti-war even when there's a Democrat doing it. But it was that I was in these really good conversations with people who I knew weren't lying to me. They genuinely believed what they believed. And I knew that I genuinely believed what I believed. And I knew that these guys were activists, that these were guys I'm getting arrested with on a regular basis, that they're, you know, we're doing civil disobedience. We're, you know, around Washington, D.C., New York, doing we did the mock combat patrol street mm-hmm. theater stuff together. And like they're arguing with me about education policy. They want more government in charge of education. And I'm going like, that can't be right. And I'm arguing for the market-based perspective, but until I was able to understand the ethical case that was at the foundation of every case I was making, I wasn't, the conversations were unsatisfying intellectually, because I was always thinking like, I just the analytical brain, like there's got to be a right answer to this. If I genuinely want the best education for every American child, this person genuinely wants the best education possible for every American child. Why can't we kind of just figure this out? And so that challenge intellectually led me to want to come to a more consistent understanding. I've actually, I'm not going to say his name because he hasn't come out publicly about this yet, but there was one guy in Iraq Veterans Against the War who was an outspoken member of the Communist Party. And him and I were somewhat rivals, you know, within Iraq Veterans Against the War. And he came to me this year. I mean, this is from working together in 2000. What was it? 2007 and 8? Mm-hmm. Like going back a decade. He contacted me recently to go, I'm sorry, I think you were right about everything. I'm obviously like, you know, a little mischaracterized there, but he was basically like, I'm not a communist anymore. And you know, so, well, you know, I don't want to like mischaracterize or misquote this particular individual, but I've heard similar, you know, maybe less dramatic cases of people coming to me saying, yeah, finally, after all those years. But that was the process for me, and it really does feel like I've settled on, yeah, this is ethics, and it's kind of like you can't unlearn what you have learned. I've tried, you know, and I would make the case that nobody who becomes a libertarian ever goes back, and that anybody who's gone back was never a libertarian in the first place, or they didn't get it. And even when you join the Libertarian Party, which I'm not just running for the nomination of, I'm a huge advocate for. In the book that we're about to deliver 200,000 copies of to every mailbox in New Orleans, you know, there's a big plug for the Libertarian Party in there. And specifically, since it's going to New Orleans, you know, the Libertarian Party of Louisiana is in there. When you join the Libertarian Party, you have to check a box that says, I do not support the use of force to achieve political or social goals. That means ethics is more important to me. Like, yes, I'm asserting, yes, even in politics, I will do the right thing. I will not be tempted by arguments of practical outcomes, of ends justifying means. No, the means must be ethical. When you really get it at that level, you don't go, fuck it. Let's just go back to pointing guns at people and telling them what to do. No, you don't. Like, it doesn't happen. So, That's been the process for me. But Chris, since you mentioned, and I want to go back to that last question that I interrupted of yours about, you know, veterans in IVAW being tempted by the left. And I want to open this up to something bigger. If you want to get back to that question, of course, yeah. Please, you know, it's definitely worth getting into in a more precise pointed way. There's a sort of identity crisis among the warrior class right now. In the modern era, where it used to be that being a warrior could mean I do what the political class tells me to do, and I'm willing to do whatever violence it takes to protect my country as defined by my government. Mm-hmm. And the lies of collectivism behind that are not surviving scrutiny in the age of the internet. And there are a lot of guys coming home. And Chris, like you mentioned about, you said in your own process that when you got out and you were looking for a more consistent worldview, that you hid in grad school for a while.
I did. Yeah. And we mentioned that before the call, before we got on the, before we hit record today. But I spent 10 years in higher education after I got out, all the way up through PhD, pretty much like almost wasting those years in a lot of ways and going through a lot of the same kind of philosophical, I guess you could say, self-torture that maybe brought me to different conclusions. But you know, in a lot of ways, I hear exactly, when I hear you speak, a lot of what you're saying, and like I said, I don't agree with everything, but a lot of what you're saying is very logical. And here's the thing, because I was surrounded by leftists in graduate school throughout the whole time. Oh, yeah. What I can say is that what you're preaching and what you're discussing is more ethically consistent than anything I've heard from the left, because the left preaches nonviolence, but I'm reading Gulag Archipelago right now by Alexander Solzhenitsyn and talks about the violence associated with leftist movements. And we know that there has been millions of deaths caused by leftism. So what you're saying right now is it's revolutionary, but it's also very logically consistent.
Right. Yeah. And you know, I'm definitely, I will put it as a mark to my own credibility that I'm one of the people who will always say, don't just believe something because I said it. If I've told you anything, if you've heard anything from me, you know, aside from the petty facts of my story, but in the bigger sense, if you have heard anything from me that rings true for you, don't accept it because you heard it from me. And this is because I want it to sink in. You know, I don't want you to, because a lot of people have been like, you know, I'll have conversations with people on the street. Oh yeah, freedom. That sounds good. You know, and you can tell that they're not really absorbing it. And if I say, hey, freedom, ethics, connects, therefore government's illegitimate, let's move past it. That's, I want you to go through that process for yourself and know it the same way that I know it as a fundamental truth. Now, Chris, part of my story I didn't get to there was that when I got out of the Marines, I went to grad school myself. I was getting a master's in political management at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and I didn't want to be the guy in front of the camera. I wanted to be a political operative. I thought that to me that was more fun, to be a campaign manager or campaign consultant type. And then with Iraq Veterans Against the War, I became a national figure with that, very quickly, and realized that I had something that I had to represent with my own face, that I had to come out and say with the credibility of, yeah, I got the freaking tattoo. Yeah. You know. Listen to me, because I was in the war and they're lying to you about, like all that kind of stuff. But there, what I wanted to get at that I think, for our audience today, and I know you have some veterans who are listening to this right now, I think there's kind of this identity crisis, right? Like this identity crisis in the warrior class is we're realizing that there's something deeper to being a warrior, to being a man generally, but not necessarily, and this is not a male exclusive thing, but to being a person who decides that their role in society is to be a protector of the innocent, to be a defender of justice, to be someone who is willing to serve a greater cause with your life. And that's a really big deal. And even, you hear the term warriors, war fighters. Yeah. That kind of stuff when you're in the Marines to blow smoke up your butt and make you feel better about who you are and what you're doing and all that. And as a result of that, I've kind of shied away from thinking about it in those terms. But I want to plug a group here, if you don't mind. This is Wake for Warriors. And these guys do wakeboarding retreats for vets. And it's a lot of disabled vets. And wake surfing. And I didn't even know wake surfing was a thing until I went out with them. But I was doing it by the end of the week, and it was freaking amazing. They got guys with one leg, I mean, with prosthetics up on boards. My buddy, Mike Nelson, who I posted a picture of him on my Instagram, if you guys want to go back and find it. He's blind. He's an Army medic, Special Forces Afghanistan veteran who is going blind and is fully legally blind. At this point, he sees shapes and shadows. As far as I know, but he carries a stick. I mean, this mm-hmm. dude's blind. They got him wake surfing. So like he's wake surfing by sound. And we actually had him do it with a mask on at one point. So like, no, he's not doing this by seeing shapes and shadows and stuff. No, he is like, he's wake surfing blind. He put on a unicorn mask. It was hilarious. Great, great pictures of that. But there was something for me, and because a lot of us, like you said about hiding, it's kind of like we're the right now, I guess we're technically middle aged, you and me. At this
technically,
point.
I don't like to say that, but yeah, we're getting there.
as life expectancy gets, I want life expectancy to keep going up, so I don't have to be middle aged ever. Right. I want to never be middle aged because life expect. Yeah, I'm never. But no, but for our generation of slightly older than enlistment age veterans. I think when you use the word hiding there, I don't want to presume about your experience, but we are kind of hiding from something, because we know, and there's so many great quotes that come to mind on this point, but that, you know, the real enemies are not to be found in the sands of some far off land, but rather right here at home. The real enemy, the assholes in the suits in Washington, D.C., who send innocent people to die for no better reason than greed and money and power. And we all know this. Oh, you know, it's like we all know it. And it's hard to admit. It's really fucking hard to admit, because there's big implications. If you joined the Marine Corps because you thought the Marine Corps was a good force in the world, if you volunteer to go to war because you thought that you were helping people by pointing guns at others, you know, if you really believe that, and then you realize and you acknowledge, you admit to yourself, the real enemies are in the Capitol. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you don't stand up and do something about that, you're not a warrior anymore.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying there. And you know, when I say hiding in grad school, I was hiding from everything. I mean, I was hiding from responsibility. I was trying to hide from my own alcoholism at the time. I was hiding from, you know, my whole family said I should go and work for the government afterwards. And I went, I did an internship at the State Department for a while afterwards. And I just couldn't deal with the narrative that was coming out of a lot of people's mouths. Cause you've been around Washington, D.C., right? You go, you socialize around there. What's a conversation like with somebody you first met in Washington, D.C.? It's, oh, where do you work? What do you do? Who do you know? What can you do for me? That kind of stuff. And that's pretty much what it was like in DC when I was down there. And, you know, in this day and age where we have this political division, and, you know, I know your own feelings about President Trump, but when I hear people categorizing him as being so evil and so, this and so that, but not necessarily taking a look at Hillary Clinton or some of the other politicians that were out there and realizing that
applying consistent standards.
right. It's pretty much the same thing. That kind of stuff drives me insane, because and I consistently find myself defending President Trump because of that, because people are applying standards to him that they're blind to when it comes to every other candidate. And it's just that with him, a lot of this stuff's a bit more apparent, a bit more out there, because he's not a trained politician like most of the
right. Well, I actually think Trump represents a major step forward for humanity, and I hate to admit this, is, you know, and put it in such positive, glowing terms, because he does still represent a lot of the current evil paradigm. Trump is willing to do violence against peaceful people to maintain his power. Like at its core, it is absolutely fucking evil. Taxation is theft. War is murder. Police are a gang. Like it's not.
And so when you say violence, you mean taxation. You mean all of these things, that, because taxation is implied violence, right?
Right. Well, hold on. I use the terms very precisely most of the time. I do slip up occasionally, but no, I use violence to refer to a physical act of aggression that is a violation of self-ownership. So when I say taxation is theft, it is that government does not own you and doesn't own your things, and it is taking something from you by coercion, and that is the threat of violence,
right,
or the threat of force. So if you don't pay your taxes, eventually they take your stuff. If you don't comply, eventually they take you and lock you in a cage. You could say that there's no violence, but no, that's violence. That's force being applied against an individual who doesn't deserve it. That's force being applied in an unethical way to violate someone's self-ownership, to take value from them. You are stealing from them. You are violating them. You are either enslaving or claiming ownership over them that's illegitimate. So Trump actually is a response. Trump's presidency, the fact that he was able to be elected president, is a response to the positive shifts underlying that in society. George W. Bush ran on a non-interventionist foreign policy and then gave us the global war on terror. Uh-huh. Donald Trump ran on a non-interventionist foreign policy, and he still doesn't have absolute control over the monstrous bureaucracy. But generally speaking, I see he's genuinely moving the needle in a positive direction there significantly. And I'm willing to say, heck yeah, celebrate that. That's awesome.
And more so than Obama, correct?
Yes. Yes. And that's, that's absolutely important to point out. Hard for the left to admit that Trump has been more distinctly anti-interventionist and promoting of peace, even though his rhetoric is combative as it is. And I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in, you know, Kissinger style real politics. Is Trump needling Kim Jong-un helpful or not? You know, hey, let him play his game and have his strategy. That's fine. I do genuinely believe that as much as Trump is that evil psychopath who wants to be president, still that he is, as an individual, somewhat more reasonable and compassionate than
the most other of the presidents who went before him.
Yeah.
The other psychopaths, yeah.
And now people are saying Trump versus Clinton. Adam, if you see this as possible, you got to support Trump over Clinton. It's like, no, because again, I see the underlying dynamics here. And if Clinton was elected, you could play all these different what if games. But in terms of like the bigger picture, not that meaningful of a change, because again, I respect that people will add up the details differently than I do. That's fine. You want to see some benefit from Trump that's more substantive? That's fine. But I could just as well play that game with Clinton and say, if Clinton was elected, we wouldn't be arguing of, is Trump just barely libertarian enough for us to be quiet and support him? No, we'd all be fighting the system. People would be waking up so much faster because there really is something distinctly offensive in the statism of Clinton. It's worse propaganda. It would be like, so a lot of people who look at the state from this perspective go, oh, presidents aren't elected, they're selected. And it's important to point out how that's true and the limitation and the truth of that, because they keep people off the ballot. They control the selection, but the actual process of selecting a president, they allow to happen by popular vote. And we have the accountability, like they can't really get in the modern era of the internet accountability and polling and exit polling, they can't really get away with, you know, stealing. Like if Hillary Clinton was polling at 90% and then on election night, they're like, nope, it's Trump by a hair. You know, they would, you know, no, I'm sorry. They just discredit the system too much. Right. So they want the best front man for the system that they can get. They want a good they want, if you're the powers that be, if you're the Rockefellers and the Warbucks and whoever it is, it's the real string pullers here, you want the American people to get the best propaganda they can get to pacify them. And the best way to find that out is market testing. And the best way to do all of this at once is with an election. And so they genuinely want there to be a certain contest in the election, but not for the reasons they stay.
Well, yeah. And as far as everything goes, I mean, the message of Clinton doesn't match up with a lot of the things we know about her. You know, for example, one of the things that really turned me off about her was her talking about the legalization of cannabis publicly, but also going back to her.
Like, you've been sitting in the Senate for how long and didn't say shit, and now right. I'm supposed
Well, not only that, she said behind closed doors that she'd never allow it to happen. She would do everything she could to fight the legalization of cannabis, which really, really turned me off because, you know, I told you before we hit record, I don't even like cannabis that much as it doesn't feel good, but it's the one thing that helped me out of all the medications I ever got for my ulcerative colitis, right? It's the one thing that helped put me into a relaxed state. It's the one thing that medically helped me. I don't touch this stuff right now because I'm out of it and I really don't like being high, but it helped me so much and it could help so many veterans out there. It could keep them off of pills. It could keep them off of opiates, which are extremely dangerous.
And I've done a lot of work on this. When I was with the Iraq Veterans Against the War in DC, I ran a peer support group for vets with PTSD. I went to the VA in DC, the flagship of VA healthcare, and said, "Hey, I'm having trouble sleeping. Can I talk to someone?" They sent me out of there with a little paper bag, 5 prescriptions. 3 of them had suicide listed as side effects. The Veterans Administration, as an arm of the government that doesn't care about you, is willing to kill you as a veteran. They're willing to see you die by poison as if it's the best medicine available, based on that lie, in order to pay off the lobbyists and the CEOs and all the shareholders of the pharmaceutical companies and the paper companies that want hemp illegal, which we have. Fortunately, it looks like that's going to be opening up very soon. Very excited about that, the farm bill. But I mean, we just look at the police. Police exist to protect you. There are police departments all over America today where they have been busting people for cannabis on a regular basis. And in their laboratories, they have rape kits that have not been tested. They are willing to let veterans die and women be raped. I should say, to let rapists go free who could otherwise be caught, just to be precise here. They are willing to do that for their own interests. Pretty sick when you step back and you understand it properly.
That's it's pretty insane, man. And I mean, as far as everything goes, that issue in and of itself is the one big thing over the past few years, I think, that's changed my own political philosophy more than anything. Just understanding that concept of the fact that if I know of something out there that could help me or that could help other people, that you could be put into a cage for trying to get that thing. That's very, very, it's disgusting to me. And, you know, I think that the more like you said, the internet allows us to educate ourselves on what's going on out there, the more the internet allows us to develop our own knowledge and our own arguments, the less they're going to be able to do this. The less they're going to be able to do this, because we're seeing a lot of pushback with cannabis now. Kratom, which is something else that I got exposed to over the last year. You know, I've seen so many different campaigns to try to make kratom illegal. Ohio, Florida, the LD50 on kratom, you have to take tons of it in order to die. They found an LD50 on it, but it's ridiculously high, and people are trying to take that away from people. I just can't get with it.
Well, Chris, if I may, since we're coming a little bit towards the end of our hour, zoom out for a little bit and talk about the bigger picture and what I'm working on here with the presidential campaign and with the New Orleans book bomb, that I should say Operation Big Easy Book Bomb as its formal title, because I'll tell the story of this book very briefly, that I started writing this when I was in jail in DC in solitary confinement, and people would send me all the best libertarian books on philosophy and literature about social science and civics and government and all that. And what I realized is that, like, very few people convert to a new worldview from a conversation. I'm honored for this opportunity to share this with your audience. But this is an introduction in that sense, because I understand when you have these deeply held beliefs, you have to displace them for yourself. I like to use the flat earth, round earth model, although the modern flat earth movement kind of ruined it for me. So screw those trolls.
You'll get hate mail from that.
People used to think, but see, I always have to do that caveat first now, but no, people, you like, I don't think that today anybody actually thinks the world is flat. I think they're all just trolling us. It's all bullshit. I'm falling for it right now because I'm even mentioning it and giving it any credibility of existing. But no, people like used to think the world was flat and the center of the universe. And then someone came along and said, maybe it's round and it's not the center of the universe. And well, you know, they kill people for saying stuff like that. But with the old model, they had all these, you know, the orbits of the stars and the celestial bodies going around this flat Earth. And in order to explain what they were observing now with telescopes, they had to make these really complicated equations. And when they came along and said, no, maybe the Earth is round, it's not the center of the universe, all of the equations got really simple. They go, oh, yeah, normal orbiting patterns of, ellipses, and it's all... yeah, math, it's geometry. It all makes sense now. Physics is normal. How about that, right? It holds together, and the universe makes more sense. And eventually, this model displaced the old one. You know, and if you had this model in your head and someone said, no, here's a simpler model, but I've done all this work. I've put all this effort. I've thought about this for years and years and years. And I did all these calculations and I put all this effort into making this work. And I know that this is true. No, it's simple. And this is exactly statism versus freedom. You know, well, no, government loves us, but the police are there to prevent this one cop helped me this one time. But there was this one war that had this one good outcome with this one thing. But sometimes taxes go to pay for roads and not all of it goes. No. Taxation is theft. War is murder. Politicians are criminals. The non-aggression principle is based in ethics. That's the foundation of freedom. And this is the truth. And it's way simpler. And it rings true. There's a lot less math. There's no excuses. There's no bullshit. You get to stop lying to yourself. And that's the gift of this message. And that's what I did my best to give people in a way that they can do the math to displace the old model of statism with this. And so it's 100 pages. I had all these great books. And I said, I'm going to take all of their strengths and none of their weaknesses, and I am going to become the very best ripoff artist the freedom movement has ever known. Take all of their best qualities and none of their bad ones and combine it into one ultimate conversion tool, primer, that lays this out in a way. Now, there are no historical facts in this book, in the sense that I'm not trying to say government is wrong because this one thing happened here no. What this lays out is the truth in a purely philosophical way that as you read it, you go, okay, all of my data, all of my observations of government, they fit into this model a lot better than what the Democrats and Republicans are trying to sell me. This makes a lot more sense. And I've done, depending on how you want to count what is a national tour, you know, I've done 5 or 6, mostly with this book, some with the Rock Banners Against the War. But since I got this message, everywhere I've gone, since I got it for myself, I've asked people, how did you wake up? How did you become a libertarian? And I've never heard anyone say, well, I was in this Facebook flame war. And this guy I was arguing with, he just made the perfect meme. And I was like, yeah, must be right about everything. You know, I've never heard anyone say, well, I was at a bar and there was this guy yelling at me about politics. And he turned the volume up just enough that I was able to really, really understand what he was saying. And that's what can, no, like it's not that it happens in quiet contemplation. You know, it happens when you're able to sit back and consider your own worldview that you've formed in your head from primarily what you've been told and how you've been lied to, and instead go, wait, no, I'm going to take my observations. I'm going to draw my own conclusions. And what this book does is it gives you that model by which you can see how your observations aren't the exception. And you're not the weirdo. Now, you're not the only one who feels this way. Your observations are correct. It's the narrative, the story that we have been fed to explain reality that's false. And getting past that is right now the most important thing that we can do for humanity, because the vast majority of human suffering that I see on Earth today is directly connected to this lie, this myth, this great superstition of authority, that if enough people vote, we can put ethics to the side. Not true.
Awesome. And your book is at freedomline.com, right?
That's it. Free in every digital format possible, including audiobook. And so Chris, the big thing I'm working on here, and this is what's so exciting, because this book is only 100 pages, I can get it printed in China, of all places, for just 30 cents each.
Well, here's something I wanted to ask you.
Hold on. I can also, you see the postage printed on the back there?
Government warning.
I can get this. Oh, the government warning's fun too. Yeah. My book was actually banned in prisons.
Oh, wow. This publication contains information which poses a threat to the security, good order, and discipline of this institution. Interesting.
Yeah. And that was, so we had a fan who bought a copy of my book and tried to send it to someone in a federal prison. And we got a letter from the warden saying that the book is banned in prisons. So I take that as a great endorsement. And what we're just, so I just raised and spent $131,000, which for me is more money than I didn't even have most of it. I was able to get donations to go directly to the printer and the bulk mailer for this one, for a big chunk of it. But it's certainly more money than I've ever put towards anything in my life. And we've got 205,000 copies of the book printed. They are, as we speak, today is December 27th. Mm-hmm. And yesterday I got an email from our bulk mailer that the books have been sorted at the warehouse in Sacramento, and they have been picked up by FedEx, and they are on their way to every individual United States Postal Service substation in the city of New Orleans. And from January 4th to January 11th, we get a week window. We can't do it all on the same day. We are using the government mail service after all. Basically, everybody in the city of New Orleans is going to get this book at the exact same time. And using the word here very metaphorically, I hope that kind of forces people to have an opinion on it. And, you know, you put a book in someone's hands, it's kind of hard to throw it away. But even the three-paragraph summary on the back, if they read that, that's a pretty good introduction. And just to be able to put that in front of, a few hundred thousand people is really exciting for me. Now, strategically, the way I see this, our movement of libertarians, and by that I mean the people who get it philosophically. I mean, if you say socially liberal, fiscally conservative, or freedom inclined, excuse me, some surveys will say that, 15% of America, or 11%, I think was the latest from Pew research, is that 11% are libertarians and kind of know what that means. I have a little bit higher standard. But I respect a broad and inclusive definition of libertarian. I want it to be inclusive. But in terms of people who understand it enough to understand it consistently and to understand the imperative implied by this, we're really only about 1% of the population. Out of 330 million, there may be 3 or 4 million of us. Depending on how you want to slice it. But there's about 10% that identify as libertarian, but don't quite understand it yet. That's kind of our low-hanging fruit. That's our target audience. If you think about conservatives and liberals, they only really represent about, in terms of like real intellectually committed people who will argue with you and advocate as liberals or conservatives, they only really make up about 5% of the population each. And that's like the hardcore base. And so for us as 1% to be fighting against two fives that are working together against us doesn't really make sense. We need to grow the moon. We need to grow the base a lot more before our engagement in politics becomes more than an exercise of spreading the message, right? And I think, and by the way, I am running to win. I'm not running an educational campaign. I believe on a separate level here that we can unite people on localization, that localization unites people because it's the everybody gets what they want strategy. I don't have to argue with you about philosophy or politics or the role of government. If you want a community organized like you want in your community, you want to live with conservatives or liberals, fine. As long as you're not holding anybody prisoner and as long as you're not forcing your views on your neighboring communities, that's okay with me. We don't have to be united under one government to be united in American values of respect for other people's rights and freedoms. That's so huge. So right now, if we can just get this message to that right 10%, and that takes us our movement really from 1% to 10%, that's enough of a political force that we can start winning elections based on localization, taking government apart from the top down until it gets down to the community, voluntary, ethical, individual level, essentially. And if we pull this off the way that I envision it in New Orleans next week, you're going to be seeing a lot more of these. And this is the big easy book bomb. You know, who knows? Maybe phase two of this operation is the American carpet book bomb.
Well, I gotta ask you one question before we get off, and this is something that you know I was thinking about before, and you just mentioned China, right? To what extent does this movement have to go international for it to become successful? And the reason why I ask that is because in the world system we live in right now, we live in a system of nation states. There is a China, there is a Russia, there is, you know, there are other powers out there that, you know, they operate on the state basis, all right? And they do wield power just like the United States. So to what extent does this need to go international, and how would that go about if you were to say become the not president of the United States and dissolve the U.S. government? Could that be done in a world where China and Russia exist?
Chris, thank you so much for setting me up for that. And if you don't mind, I have some very passionate feelings about that, because I believe a big part of what you have implied there, and I know to a certain extent you're just playing devil's advocate, is that somehow being more free, America, being more American, being more in line with the vision of a national defense that our founders advocated, is somehow going to make us weaker in the world.
Well, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is let's say we dissolve the U.S. government, right? And I'm not saying that you know that involves.
What if China takes over?
Yeah. What if
China wants to invade? Right. That's right, cool. Right. That's. Am I right? That's
right.
That's
right. Exactly. What if they come?
What if China invade? Right. No. And it's. The question is a reflection of how dumb, dangerous, ineffective, and un-American militarism is. The founders of this country were against having what they called a standing army of any kind. They were for a militia-based defense because they knew it was more ethical and more effective. And we have been lied to from the very beginning about war when it comes to what war is. We are taught that wars is just in the very language. Wars are fought between countries. It was America versus China versus Japan versus Germany. It's utter bullshit nonsense. Wars are not fought between countries. You got to stop and think about this and really absorb it for a second. Wars are conducted by governments using violence to expand their protection rackets. And I cannot stand it. When you said we earlier talking about Iraq, I go, okay, yeah, we can say that. Mm-hmm. But when I hear the average American say, we invaded Iraq, no, the fuck we didn't. You were sitting at home on your couch. Mm-hmm. We didn't. It's really important to separate responsibility here. The military did this. The government did this. Not the people, not the country. America is too good for this government. And it is an insult to America to say America did something when it's the government that did it. That is a huge insult. And so if you say we need a military to keep us safe, no, having a military makes us less safe because governments will only invade countries to take them over if they think they can govern them. Mm-hmm. Why is Afghanistan the graveyard of empires? Because they refuse to be governed. The best defense, as the founders of this country advocated, is a well-armed population that refuses to be governed by anyone. You're afraid of China coming in? I say, come on in to a free America. Shop at our stores, dine at our restaurants. But the minute you send a tax collector to my door, he's going to get shot in the face because this is America. You think China's going to invade that country where Admiral Yamamoto in World War II said, no, we can't invade the mainland because there's a rifle behind every blade of grass? Yeah, that's America. No one is going to take over this country, only ourselves. It is only our own internal weakness, our own conflict, our own gullibility, our own inclinations to injustice and violence and coercion through government and control and fear that lead us to the enslavement of the tyranny that we experience today. No one can fuck with America but America. And we are the answer to this. China is not a threat to a free people. The government of China is the greatest threat to the Chinese people. When we talk about this movement going global, absolutely. And what makes me excited about this moment for the United States is that if we really claim this, if we really take this opportunity, if we get to lead the world in freedom once again, as we did in the first American Revolution, incidentally, by once again overthrowing the biggest empire the world has ever seen. It used to be the British. Now it's the American governments. And when we do that, what we will have given to the world is true Americanism, that heritage of not just being bigger and badder and better than everybody else. That's bullshit. No, but being righteous, being willing to put your life on the line for something you believe in and stand up for what you know to be right. And right now we know that government is wrong, fundamentally, undeniably, irrevocably, at its core, ethically wrong. And the sooner we move past it as a species for humanity, the better off we will all be. So when America does this, again, you think America gets rid of our federal government and, I don't know, GDP doubles and productivity doubles and people are freer and happier. You think the people of China are going to go to their government and say, hey, let's invade those happy people? No, they're going to go. No, no, no. And if China's government goes to the Chinese people and says, oh, look, America's weak now, let's invade them. No, the Chinese people are going to say, wait a second. They got rid of their central government and the sky didn't fall? What are we paying for our central government again? Oh, yeah, way too much. We don't need you either. That's how this is going to play out. That's how these dominoes fall. And I could be wrong about my premises here, but I can't find any that are more in line with observable historical facts. And we're about to find out in practice if I'm right.
Awesome. Adam, I want to thank you so much for coming on. And, like I said, everybody head over to freedomline.com. Check out Adam's book. He's also got Kokesh for President up. And be sure you check out that Wikipedia page because you'll be like, holy shit.
And Chris, if I may just say one more thing again, thank you for this opportunity. And for people who are watching this, especially in today's internet, it's crucial that we support independent media. So please support Chris's work and any other independent media outlets online who you know are spreading a message of righteous contradiction of the mainstream media.
Right. You're not going to get this on CNN, Fox News, or MSNBC. So talk to you guys later and get out there and live your best lives while you can.